You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the New Books Network. I am Emily Allen, your host for this episode. And our guest for today's discussion is John Shaw, author of Following the Drums, African-American Fife and Drum Music in Tennessee, published by the University Press of Mississippi in 2022. So a little bit more about the book, Following the Drums, African-American Fife and Drum Music in Tennessee, is an epic history of a little-known African-American music form, and carefully documenting the music's early uses for commercial advertising and sports promotion, Shaw follows the strands of the music through the nadir of African-American history during post-Reconstruction up to the form's rediscovery by musicologists and music researchers during the blues and folk revival of the late 1960s and early 1970s. So overall, Following the Drums is a journey through African-American history and Tennessee history with a fascinating form of music powering the story. And then a little bit more about our guest speaker today. John M. Shaw is a musicologist, musician, writer, and blogger, currently pursuing a doctorate at the University of Memphis. So thank you, John, for joining us today on the New Books Network.
I'm glad to be here.
Awesome. So before we talk about your book here, can you tell us a little bit more about you?
Well, I'm probably older than the average doctoral student. I'm 53 years old. I was born in 1967 in Dallas, Texas, but I've lived in Memphis since I was about 6 years old. And I'm a disciple of Dr. David Evans, the noted folklorist and ethnomusicologist. And it was he that really helped me develop my love of this discipline and Black music in general, music of the Black diaspora. So I'm very interested in documenting particularly disappearing African-American musical traditions, or endangered might be a better term, traditions that are being threatened by the rise of commercial music and the recording industry. So that's kind of where I'm at. I'm very much into brass band music, Mardi Gras Indian tribe culture, Black fife and drum, Black majorette drumming, in Memphis and other southern cities, some of these traditions that are sadly fading because of the popularity of radio and television and TikTok and other such young people's pastimes. Yeah.
Gotta watch out for the youth. Just kidding.
Yeah.
But cool. So kind of thank you for painting this bigger picture here for us in terms of like where your interests are and, you know, your background. So, you know, talking more about this book within this journey that you've been talking about, how did this actual book get started? Like, how long ago did you start it? That kind of thing.
It's kind of bizarre because I mentioned it in the foreword to the book. My best friend in high school was named Jesse Yancey. He was a African-American football player, and he lived out in Oak Grove, which was a rural community beyond Bartlett. And sitting on his front porch with him one day, we heard drums booming from a distance. And I asked him what it was. And he had a dry sense of humor. He said, there's a tribe back in these woods. Well, I knew he was pulling my leg. But later on, I asked another friend of mine that had been there that day years later, what actually was that? He said there was something going on at a lodge. So, you know, there were Black benevolent societies in rural Shelby County, like the Independent Pole Bearers, which was later changed to Paul Bearers, but I discussed that in the book. They did not make an error. They meant to say pole bearers, and that's more firmly discussed in my book. They drilled with poles to drums. But in addition, the Social Benevolent Society, the United Sons and Daughters of Zion, and it was the tradition to beat these drums to announce that someone in the society had died. There's some evidence that in, you know, way back they were played at funerals. So this may have been what I heard. I still don't have definitive knowledge of that, but it was early enough, 1983, that it might have still been going on. What I do know is that later on, about 2017, I became very interested in Fayette County, which is a county in Tennessee that once was about 98% African-American. It sits directly north of Marshall County, Mississippi, which has produced some very famous blues musicians like R.L. Burnside and Junior Kimbrough. And so I'm thinking demographically, geographically, as far as the landscape of the terrain, Fayette and Marshall are twins, though one's in Tennessee and one's in Mississippi. So why can I not name a blues musician from Fayette? And did they ever have fife and drum bands? Now, it turns out Mississippi Fred McDowell was born in Fayette, but I did not, but he's associated with Mississippi. So I did research. I did a Google search. I said fife and drum band, Fayette County, Tennessee, and got results. But the results I got blew my mind. It didn't say Fayette. It said United Sons and Daughters of Zion, number 9, fife and drum band, Bartlett, Tennessee. I live in Bartlett. I'm living here now. Went through almost 11 grades of school in Bartlett. So you can imagine my shock. And I was even more shocked to find that this band was recorded by a Swedish man named Bent Olsen and had been released on a compact disc. So then when I started digging further, who was this band? How did Bartlett have a Black fife and drum band? Because the genre is associated with Mississippi. I found that the leader of this band was named Lum Guthrie, and I about fell out of my seat because I graduated from Bartlett High School with his grandson, Bobby Merriweather, and knew Bobby. So I started having to dig into this. This is important. Most people think that Black fife and drum is restricted to Mississippi. Some people who read about it know that it once was found in Georgia in 1970, but there's been very little reference to it in any other southern state. And nobody's ever tried to connect it to anything way back. Everybody says, oh, it sounds vaguely West African, which it does. But nobody's ever said, well, how far back does it go or what are the roots of it? And so as I did this research, I really wanted to do that. And one reason it had never been done is that newspapers were not searchable by keyword. You would have had to go through archives and libraries and pour over reels of microfilm for years, and you might not find anything. But now we have newspapers.com, newspaperarchive.com, genealogy bank, and these allow you to search lots of digitized newspapers by keywords such as fife, drum. And when you do, you start seeing all of these references to Black political rallies during Reconstruction with fife and drum bands. Black fife and drum band. And even more remarkably, Black drummers before the Civil War and Black drummers in the Confederate units. I mean, I was just astounded. So I knew there were Black drummers in the Union Army. I did not know there were Black drummers in the Confederate Army. So it was very bizarre to find all of this and important. I found out that the drummer who played for Andrew Jackson at the Battle of Chalmette was named Jordan Noble Banks. I didn't know that we knew his name. He's a black man. He played at Jackson's funeral procession in Ohio. I was just absolutely amazed. We have the names of legendary black drummers from the Revolutionary War who die in the 1850s in places like Utah County, Georgia. So, I mean, I was just absolutely amazed at what I did find, and that there were black drummers in Southern militias before the Civil War. That's just shocking. I found that from a dissertation that a Canadian young woman had written, that there was a festival music in West Africa called Jongo that consisted of drums and flutes. So finding these dual roots, in other words, West African roots of it, and then American military roots of it, which Africans brought to this country would have heard and encountered, militia musters, training days that were done, because everybody was in the militia in those days. It wasn't just the National Guard. Everybody, all men, were expected to be involved. And so this was very interesting stuff. So that's how it started, and that's how I got to work on it.
Yeah, that's amazing. Like, you raised a really good point about how now that we have these digital resources, how much further we can go. And I was like blown away by like what you were saying, all these places that these bands were popping up, and all these different scenarios. And I thought it was really interesting too. Like, over the course of the book, you could really tell that you'd spend a lot of time with some of these like standard Tennessee newspapers, for instance. And I thought it was really impressive how you sort of took a step back and said, this paper would paint the same event this way and this way, so you kind of had sort of a almost ethnographic reading of the sources along the way, in terms of like, you were good about kind of rounding out the descriptions of these bands with different types of papers. Can you talk about that process too, about how you sort of familiarized yourself enough with these different, newspapers, these different sources, to kind of like really step back that way?
Well, you can kind of notice the tendencies of the different papers. Memphis had so many at that time. I mean, the Bulletin, the Commercial, the first Commercial, there was a second one later, the Avalanche, the Appeal, and the Post. And of course, the Post is the most interesting because it was run by a Union general who had fought in the Civil War and stayed in Memphis afterwards to uphold the standards of the Republican Party. And he was very interested in making sure that blacks could vote, and he covered their activities. So it's a very interesting paper. It was not run by African Americans, but it was run by a general of the Union Army who considered himself sympathetic to African Americans. And so, whose name was Eaton. And so a lot of useful information, including the first mention of the Poll Bearers as an organization, occurs in the Post. But the Public Ledger was as anti-black as the Post was pro-black, and the Appeal only slightly less, perhaps. The Avalanche is weirdly ambivalent, and at times actually embraced the socialists that were running the National Party during the 1870s, which was just absolutely amazing for a white Southern newspaper. But they were. They said, the solution to racial problems, solution to all these problems, is to support the National Party, the party of working men. And I thought, that's pretty radical for 1870-something Memphis. But it was cool, to see that. And they all covered these doings. Even the most racist papers from Memphis were fascinated by the organizations and the activities that the black community chose to engage in. They were unique and different, and I guess it caught their attention. After about 1879 or 80, it seems as if the newness kind of wore off, and they just quit mentioning these things. But during the 1870s, there's a lot of mention, and to the point of mentioning the slogans on banners, which I thought was really cool, the colors and dresses of uniforms of the various benevolent societies that played. I thought that was really awesome. It's like we actually the Appeal actually told us what color they had on, what the colors of their outfits. I thought that was kind of interesting. And another thing I have to mention is the descriptions that so resemble New Orleans as to be mind-boggling. In other words, the appeal complained about a Black band. Why do they play slow, mournful music on the way to the cemetery and then come back beating the stuffing out of the bass drum and playing this lively, upbeat music on the way back? Well, that's so interesting because we think of that as something New Orleans does. And I'm strongly of the opinion that this was probably ubiquitous in Southern towns and cities, Pensacola, Mobile, Memphis, Jackson, Mississippi. I'm just very suspicious that this was not something that was unique to New Orleans. What is unique to New Orleans is it didn't die out there. In other words, where it faded in Memphis and other cities, it continued down there and thus is preserved there in a way. But so all of this was very interesting. And you do get a tone of these papers as you read through years of them and issues of them. You start seeing their emphases and how they feel about certain things.
Yeah. And kind of going more into the content, you were talking about this a little bit with like the benevolent societies often being the backing for these bands. And you talked earlier about, you know, political rallies and that kind of things. Can you kind of, for our listeners, talk a little bit more about some of the common scenarios that you would see, like types of events and rituals you would see these bands in for listeners?
Well, obviously, the societies were formed, as I mentioned in the book, in lieu of life insurance, which really wasn't well known in the South for anyone prior to the war. And after the Civil War, the ex-Confederates began creating life insurance companies. Jefferson Davis moved to Memphis and helped form the Southern Life Insurance Company, but they would not write policies for Black people. So Black people who recently freed from slavery basically began to form these benevolent societies, and which in New Orleans they are called social aid and pleasure clubs, which is a good picture of what they were. But in the most of the South, they were called benevolent societies, and a man could join and pay his dues and knew that if he got sick, they would chop his wood for him and take care of his wife and kids. And if he died, they would bury him with music. That was kind of the way it was referred to, with music. And so the societies would pray, you know, to call attention to themselves and to their members. And we have accounts in Memphis of them parading in memory of Charles Sumner, the member of Congress. I think he was a senator who labored so hard on behalf of Black Americans. They paraded in honor of Thomas Swan, the founder of the Pole Bearers, who died in 1874, which was described as the largest parade in the history of Memphis. And this was a Black parade. Absolutely, you know, so this, in honor of the 15th Amendment, there was a parade and all the different Black organizations and bands participated in honor of the amendment that gave them the right to vote. So these were common. Picnics were another place where this would take place because the dues that members paid did not generate enough income to pay for all the burying and keeping up the cemeteries and things. So they'd held 2-3-4-day picnics, Memorial Day, which was back then was called Decoration Day, Labor Day, July the 4th. Huge holiday in the Black community and pretty much only in the Black community in those days. White Southerners considered it a day of mourning, and some of them actually draped their houses with Black sashes because Vicksburg was surrendered on the 4th. That really doesn't change much until after World War II. So it's very interesting how, you know, these were the primary events. Others would have been meetings of the Loyal League or the Union League, which were political organizations sponsored amongst the Black community by the Republican Party. And to rally them to go to the polls. They were typically marched to the polls because there was safety in numbers. And, you know, this would go on. They'd play these political rallies. Later, we start seeing it in other ways. We see it in connection with minor league baseball. certainly in Nashville. That seems to be the only city where it was prominent, although there's a mention of a guy saying, we had a band like that when we had minor league in Mobile, but this band in Nashville's better. So evidently, other baseball clubs may have used that method. They actually were known, though I've got descriptions of them carrying a sign, baseball today, 3 p.m. Sulphur Dell Park, in front of the band that was playing. But they were generally called an Ethiopian fife and drum band, and on one article, a Senegambian fife and drum band. But it appears that they had a name, and it was called the Spirits of 76. Now, what's interesting is, later we've got them being hired by a group of white women called the Tennessee Suffrage League, and they are hiring this black fife and drum band from the baseball games to play for their rally where they're trying to get the state of Tennessee to give women the vote, 1916. So I think that's kind of interesting. And then the Rotarians hire them to go to the National Rotary Convention in Atlanta, and they play down there. And, you know, they're kind of a bridge to the modern era. The last member died in 1947. And was mentioned in the Nashville Tennessean. But 5 years before that, Alan Lomax had rediscovered the genre down in Quitman County, Mississippi, by discovering Sid Hemphill, the father of Jesse May Hemphill. So this was very interesting stuff. But so, yeah, advertising, parties, picnics, possibly funerals, although certainly not in the modern era. And the bass drum would be beat in a certain pattern to called the dead lick to warn people in rural black communities that someone had died. They didn't have telephones, and so they would tell the bass drummer to go to the hill where they had picnics and beat the bass drum. They said, if the conditions were right, that could carry 5-6 miles, sometimes more than that. And people would hear it, and that certain beat they knew meant that someone had died. And then the marshals in the organization would go around to the doors and knock on doors and say, you know, Mrs. Harris died. And they would have to go to the funerals or be fined. Every member had to attend every funeral. That was the way it was set up. So it's a very interesting thing, and very West African, if you ask me. Beating the drum to tell people that someone had died, to send those messages, was a very West African kind of thing. And it's very interesting.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, and it's kind of amazing, like all these different scenarios, all these different social contexts that you're talking about here, that being in these bands gave a lot of these black performers, you know, access to a number of spaces and a different, you know, kind of some mobility here socially throughout the 19th and as you continue to 20th century, that really was, you know, the book is kind of also painting here the role of these African-American performers and, you know, communities in terms of how they're claiming public space or places in society here, right? Especially like as you talked about with like the different political rallies and stuff too. So can you talk a little bit how, over the course of the time period that you look at the book, how did the reception to these performers fluctuate, right? Like at one point were people like, yes, fife and drum bands, and other points were they like, ooh, no, no more, like specifically.
Early on, mostly, ooh, no. There was obviously a considerable amount of resentment, at least in Tennessee, partially because obviously, you know, you've got people that have been defeated in war. And the result of them being defeated in war was that under the governor of the time, Governor William Gannaway Brownlow, he said, traitors must be made, treason must be made odious. So his view was that anyone who supported the Confederacy would be stripped of their civil rights. They can't vote. They can't hold public office. So most of the most white Tennesseans, unless they were willing to join the Republican Party and claim under oath that they had never supported the Confederacy, were stripped of their voting rights. They could not vote. Then African Americans were given the vote. So there was this extreme bitterness that, you know, Black people were being allowed to vote and whites who had moved to Tennessee from the North, but majority of native born whites, except for a handful that claimed they never supported the Confederacy and probably actually had, were not being allowed to vote. So there was this very, this bitterness, this hatred, and it couldn't safely be taken out on the North. So it was basically directed at the freedmen, at Black people. And, you know, in Memphis, the hatred was just directed very heavily toward Edward Shaw, who was appointed wharf master of the city. And there was a considerable amount of hatred for him. He was very clearly very intelligent and extremely militant. If you read his speeches, it's remarkable. It's a wonder he wasn't murdered. But he was very eloquent. He ran for sheriff of Shelby County. So, you know, early on, the fife and drumming was clearly resented in the white community, and you see it. You see the complaints. Do we live amongst civilization or barbarity? One man wrote. Another one said, you know, our women and children are not safe just because they're hearing this drumming on the edges of town. And, you know, Barbara Lewis, who was the Republican congressman at the time, said, we are men of peace. But no one is drilling militarily, but the commercial appeal said, we don't believe Barbara Lewis. The Blacks are drilling and preparing for war against us. And there was really this perception that it meant, you know, in the white community, fife and drum was a military music. It wasn't used for anything else. And if Black people were doing this, they must be planning to raise an army. And that was kind of the mentality. It varied from place to place, and the further east you went in Tennessee, where whites were Republicans and never had owned slaves, they were not nearly as hostile, and that's obvious. In Nashville, once it became associated with baseball, there was quite a there was a different attitude. You see letters to the Tennessean for and against. Only in the 60s and 70s did it become this kind of universally acclaimed thing, because we're getting into a period where there's this idea that folklore is rapidly vanishing. We're losing it. We've got to capture it and keep it before it disappears. And that was kind of the view of Charles Seeger to a point, and his wife, Ruth Crawford Seeger. And it filters down to Pete Seeger and the Almanac Singers. And, you know, you get to Dave Von Ronk and Bob Dylan, and suddenly you've got this whole folk thing. Folk music is important. We like it. Young kids like it. And so the Smithsonian has a folk festival, and Newport has a folk festival. And, you know, Smithsonian and Newport both call up the Youngs, G.D. Young and why am I drawing a blank? But anyway, the Young family out of Como, which Alan Lomax had discovered, and they're a fife and drum band. At one festival, they were called the Southern Fife and Drum Corps, and at another one, they're called the Afro-American Fife and Drum Corps. But either way, people are getting exposed to this music, and now there's another one down in Como, used to be called the Como Fife and Drum Band. They play the inaugural New Orleans Heritage Festival. So this music becomes associated with music that is endangered, that's being rediscovered along with these ancient blues men that are being rediscovered, like Skip James and Furry Lewis. And so it all plays into an ethos that probably not accidentally is occurring alongside the civil rights movement and white kids going south to work for SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, going south to work for CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality. So you've got this whole ethos where there's an interest in racial equality, there's an interest in folklore, there's an interest in being counterculture, hippies. So all of this is playing into this, and fife and drum suddenly becomes a very popular music, at least with the counterculture youth during the 60s and early 70s. And there are some documentary efforts. Alan Lomax did the lion's share of that. David Evans does some as well. He makes this wonderful film called Gravel Springs Fife and Drum about Otha Turner, who's by far the most famous fife player, black fife player in American history. But having said that, that's about the only time it's ever been universally acclaimed. And I sadly feel that even now the interest is waning again. There's only two bands left that we know of, and they're both in Mississippi within a few miles of each other. And it just seems like the music is endangered again because kids are into rap and they're into R&B music and other popular culture things, and not in, you know, this is something they seem to be saying old people do. So that's kind of where we're at. But for a lot of the years, there was a lot of hostility toward it. It was associated with black people voting. That wasn't popular in the South. It was associated with black people running for office, associated with black people saying we have a right to parade the streets of these southern towns. That's not going to go uncontested. After the Nader, after the 1890s, when segregation becomes a law everywhere. So, you know, the music was, and then it disappears. It's there, but because, you know, race relations were at such a low point, why we call it the Nader, white newspapers don't mention it anymore. They're not going to black picnics. The only time they're going to mention a black picnic is if there's a cutting or a shooting. They're not going to mention what kind of music was held. They might mention black people had a two-day picnic south of town. That's all they're going to say. You know, they're not going to mention who played or what kind of music was there. Fortunately, we've got some interviews with people like Honey Boy Edwards, where he tells us what kind of music was there. He mentions a picnic in Oakland, Tennessee, Fayette County, where there was both blues. He said Memphis Minnie was there and a fife and drum band. Awesome. Thank goodness somebody interviewed him when he was living in the 90s about what he could remember. But that's, you know, so that's kind of where it is.
Yeah, and I was, when you were talking about all that too, I know at some point you talked about how also, like, for instance, like brass bands kind of at some points also became, you know, more of a favored like wind band tradition. So can you talk a little bit about that, about how maybe the reception, you know, maybe compares to something like other wind band traditions, like the brass bands and stuff?
Well, I think that, you know, the brass bands were a function of the cities. Don't get me wrong. There were fife and drum bands during Reconstruction, at least in the bigger cities too, but it was easier to get brass instruments in the city because you had a war, and it's an unusual kind of war because both armies were from the United States, you know, it's a civil war. So as the Confederates are demobilizing and as the Union is demobilizing, they had bands. So now they're breaking all this up and there's a bunch of instruments. And we think that these instruments end up in secondhand shops and in the bigger cities, New Orleans, Memphis, Mobile. And so black people are now being paid for their labor, not probably what they should be paid for their labor, but they're being paid and they can afford to go get their heart's desire. I want a trumpet or a cornet. I want a saxophone. I want a drum. There's also stories that the Union Army, in some cases, left behind instruments and gave them to the black community. Certainly in Tallahassee, the tradition is that the departing Union soldiers gave drums to the black community. And as late as 1992, they were beating drums on Emancipation Day in parks in Tallahassee. Whether that still goes on, Geraldine McGregory mentions it in a book she wrote. She's an awesome writer. And whether that's going on since 1992, I don't know. But it did go on as late as 1992. And, you know, it's not always uncommon for there to be drums without the fife, either because the fife player died or they just don't see the need. But at any rate, the brass bands tend to be in the cities. There are exceptions. So Frederick, I'm drawing a blank today. I'm getting old already. The man that wrote Ben Hur and Gaul, Frederick Ramsey, he encountered a rural brass band in Alabama. But that's not that common. Most of our brass bands were in the cities. I've got plenty of references in Memphis, in Pensacola, in New Orleans, and even in towns near Memphis, like Somerville. So it's not uncommon in the cities. And the cities start passing ordinances against fife and drum. We didn't talk about that. I don't even discuss it all that much in my book. But fife and drum has a problem that... I think some of it is subterfuge, meaning there was just a lot of racism, period. But there's also the fact that bass drums, even today, you're at a parade. If you've got horses around, bass drums scare horses. They scare dogs. They scare cats. And nowadays, there's a modern problem that they didn't have back then. They set off car alarms. But back then, they'd scare a horse. Well, you say, what's the big deal? Well, the horse was attached to a carriage. So the fife and drum band comes past, scares the horse. Horse takes off down the road uncontrollably with the carriage. And maybe the horse gets killed. Maybe the carriage gets broken into firewood. Maybe the woman riding in the carriage gets injured or killed. So the cities start passing these ordinances to prevent horse runaways. At least that's the official reason, banning fife and drum bands. Now, how that's any different from the brass bands, I don't know. But they forbid them. And so this is probably another reason why fife and drum becomes associated with the rural areas and brass bands more so with the cities, with the bigger areas. And that's going to remain the case from, you know, the 1880s on. But there's remarkable similarities in the cities, and particularly New Orleans. The brass bands are used at the funerals, just like the fife and drum bands would be in the rural community. And in some cases, such as Henning, Tennessee, there seems to be this interchangeable nature. In other words, the drummers who played for the Henning Brass Band, the Black Brass Band, were also the drummers that played in the fife and drum band there. So there seems to be some back and forth there in some communities. Denmark, Tennessee, maybe another place. We know about their Black Brass Band. We don't know about a fife and drum band, except that Charles Wolfe claimed he found one in Madison County in the 1980s. I ran that lead down as far as I could follow it and didn't come up with anything tangible. But we know Denmark, Tennessee had a big black fife and drum band, brass band. And it seems likely that there may have been a fife and drum adjunct to that brass band. So this is the way, and some of these guys had all. Robert Wardlow, that I mentioned in my book, I was amazed, by the way, I just have to say this, to be able to put together really human biographies of these ancient black musicians from white southern newspapers. It was just absolutely amazing. I've got the Memphis Appeal, I think it's the Appeal, where the guy kicks a hole in Stephen Grayson's bass drum and he says, if I get my hands on the guy that did it, I'll kill him. And I mean, this is 1872, you know, and I'm just amazed here. I mean, you get something of Grayson's personality, you learn something about, you know, and Robert Wardlow. Robert Wardlow's going to buck everybody. He says, I'm a black Democrat. I support the ex-Confederates. I'm on their side. Lincoln once offered the South to let them keep their slaves if they would end the war, and I don't trust him, and I'm a black Democrat. And he called his band Robert Wardlow's Conservative Colored Band. And the white Southern newspapers loved it. They said, hire him. He's reliable and he's a good guy and he's on our side. You know, you support him. But he had a field band. That's another way of saying a fife and drum band. He had a brass band, which, you know, and he had a string band. And he advertises all three in the papers. He said, you know, I've got a field band, I've got a string band, which means banjo and violin or fiddle, and I've got a fife and drum. He called it a field band. So I think that's very interesting. You know, this is not entirely uncommon. You want to, if you're in business, you want to please what people want, and you never know which one they might want. So you got them all ready to line up. And even weirder, he said, I'll play at any watering place. And I discussed that in the book. And I said, today we'd say he's saying he'd play in a bar. but I think he really meant Iuka Springs, you know, Mineral Wells in Mississippi, these resort hotels where people went to get the water, take the mineral water. I think that's what he meant by watering place, but it's very interesting, you know. And so, yeah, all these bands were around, you know. There were black string bands, there were black fife and drum, there were black brass bands, and all these things were had their popularities. Some of them were on the boats going up and down the Mississippi River. So it's all quite interesting. Yeah.
Thank you so much for sharing that wealth of information. There's so many fascinating, I think, rabbit holes that you could probably continue beyond even this book and whatnot. And, you know, you've presented for the reader here, and like you were just getting at, so much information and so many possibilities to explore further with this fife and drum band tradition. And you were also talking earlier a little bit about how, you know, during the 60s and 70s, during that interest in folklore and whatnot, that there was sort of a resurgence for a minute in this tradition. So how do you see yourself in this book building on or maybe countering that wave that was going on in the 60s and 70s? In other words, in 2022, what is your hope that this book and that your work will also offer in terms of, you know, this tradition?
Well, I'll be honest. New Orleans brass band music thrills me, and I take a lesson from it because it hit a nadir in the late 1960s. It was down to two bands, and then they began to become sporadic. And Danny Barker, who was still living at the time, was asked by the Fairview Baptist Church to start a club to keep youth out of trouble. So he starts a brass band called the Fairview Brass Band. It later becomes the Hurricanes, and Leroy Jones, the trumpet player, the young trumpet player from New Orleans, was a member. A group of black kids in New Orleans sees the Fairview Baptist Church brass band and says in the early 70s and says, "We want to do that too." And they call themselves the Rebirth Brass Band. And then another group of kids sees, I guess, the Rebirth and the Fairview Baptist Church Band, and they call themselves the Dirty Dozen. And so we go from this point at where it looked like it was going to go extinct in about 1970. And today there are 15 or 16 black brass bands in New Orleans, with new ones forming all the time. And there are New Orleans-inspired brass bands in other cities. There's, you know, Mama Dig Downs and different ones that are up north in Chicago, New York. I mean, even in overseas, even in Japan and other places, there are now New Orleans inspired brass bands. So if brass band music could come that close to extinction and be brought back from the abyss through awareness, my hope is that black fife and drum, which is down to the Hurt family band from Sardis, and Sharday Thomas and the Rising Star Fife and Drum Band from Senatobia, I'm hoping that through interest and awareness, maybe young kids, particularly African-American kids, may say, this is worth keeping. Let's pick up this tradition and roll with it, you know. And I'm under no illusions. Rebirth did not simply preserve black brass band music. They changed it. They brought bebop into it. They brought Caribbean music into it. But that's better than extinction. And I'm sure that if young people pick up black fife and drum music, it's not going to entirely remain what it was with Otha Turner and that older generation. They're going to bring some aspect of new music into it, perhaps. But that's, again, that's better than extinction. Dead things don't change, but things that are living do adapt and develop. And I'm hoping that this will become a living form of music and not simply something that we have videos of when it did exist. Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you, John, for kind of reflecting on that, and lots of exciting stuff, folks. You need to read this book and learn about this history here. Was there anything that we haven't touched on already that you wanted to share with our listeners about your book project or, you know, this tradition in general?
Well, I think we've covered the bulk of it. I do think that evidence of it in other states is going to be out there. I'd be shocked if it wasn't widespread in Gadsden County, Florida. I have a feeling it went on there quite a bit at one time. There are references to it in the Sea Islands of Georgia. I think it's going to prove to be in Alabama. I've got one reference to it in Louisiana. So I think we're going to find that this was a lot more ubiquitous than has been thought. And I want, you know, more about this type of music in other states to come out, Texas and elsewhere, because I think it, you know, needs to be discussed.
Try to work on that for the Alabama side of things. I'll get on that. Thank you, John, for talking to us about your work here. I was curious, what other projects are you working on right now?
My dissertation is very different in a way. I mean, similar and different. It goes back to a paper I wrote for Dr. Evans 21 years ago called Action Speaks Louder Than Words, Black Music and the Recording Industry in Shreveport, Louisiana. And in this dissertation, I'm arguing that Shreveport should not have been overlooked. It should have been placed alongside Muscle Shoals and Memphis and Nashville as a Southern regional recording city. And so I'm discussing the studios, the clubs, and the performers that made Shreveport a scene during the 60s and 70s particularly. But I'm actually going back to 1948, which is the year that Stan's Record Store opened and the year that the Louisiana Hayride was started. And I'm discussing the blues recordings that were made there in the 40s and 50s and then going on into the modern soul music era. And really all the way up to 1998, 50 years, which is a pretty neat slice of Shreveport music history. And, you know, I think this book needs to be written. I live in Memphis, but Memphis has been written about and written about and written about. There are stories I hope to tell about Memphis or about West Memphis, Arkansas. But at the same time, I think this Shreveport work is desperately needed. And so that's where I'm headed at this point. And because I wrote the paper 21 years ago, I've got a framework really already in place, kind of a, you know, a foundation that's been laid. So, you know, I'm beginning to work on it.
Excellent. I will look forward to reading that in the future. Okay. But thank you for sharing, you know, your thoughts with us and talking to us about the book.
All right. It was a pleasure.
And listeners, just to give you a quick recap, this was a discussion with John Shaw, author of Following the Drums, African American Fife and Drum Music in Tennessee, published by the University Press of Mississippi in 2022. This is Emily Allen, and I'll see you next time here on the New Books Network.